This is the Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. We have our regular guest, Lane County Senior Public Health Officer, Dr. Patrick Ludke. And we also have Dr. Serena Black, a pediatric hospitalist at Peace Health, with us. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. So yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority said 13% of COVID cases statewide are in children. And Dr. Black, can you start by just telling us what you've seen at Peace Health and the cases among younger people?
Yes, yeah. So we are seeing an increase in prevalence in the pediatric population, which is proportional, just as we're seeing an increase with this more infectious variant overall. And remembering that children 12 and under are still not eligible for vaccine. So it's anticipated that we would see a rise in that population. So we've seen a lot more families calling in or coming in for testing for children that are exposed or becoming symptomatic, mostly still in our outpatient clinics. We have had a little bit of an increase in the number of COVID positive pediatric patients that we've been caring for in the hospital as well. Although the good news is that many of those patients are coming in for other health issues and testing positive for COVID, but not being admitted for primarily more severe coronavirus infection. But it's definitely more in the last month than we had in the first year of the pandemic. So there has been an uptick in the number of kids who are being hospitalized as well.
I understand, too, that Lane County does not have a pediatric intensive care unit. So what are the options if there is a severe case?
Excellent question. For the entire state of Oregon, really the only intensive care units for children are in Portland. So for those more severe cases, and we have had a few over the course of the pandemic who we were evaluating for the multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children that can be associated with coronavirus. They do get transferred to the intensive care units up in Portland, where they can have access to more intensive respiratory support and also additional subspecialties that we may not have available for children here locally. So that is really our only option. It had been challenging at times this summer. The intensive care units were experiencing a high level of pediatric volume. So there were times that bed availability was a little bit tight.
Well, with school underway in Lane County in person, starting with you, Dr. Black, how confident are you feeling about sending kids back to school, back to the classroom?
That is a very personal question because I have daughters who are 8 and 11, as well as being a pediatrician in this community. It obviously touches me close to home. I have a lot of confidence in our local school administration and the school board. They've been very thoughtful in developing safety plans for kids to go back as safely as we can achieve, and really relying on a lot of our available public health measures, things like masking, hand hygiene, access to hand sanitizer, distancing when possible, and careful thought around, best ventilation that we can achieve in the different facilities. That's the best we can do, I think. And I am confident that there's been a lot of thought put into keeping our kids safe and helping to support them as they're kind of making this transition into a setting where they're going to need to keep the masks on all day and all of those pieces.
And Dr. Ludke, what are your thoughts on that as we resume school?
Well, I would echo much of what Dr. Black said and agree with it. I think all that I would add is from an epidemiological standpoint, when you put people together in a smaller space and they're breathing the same air, there will be more exposures and we're going to see more cases. The bulk of the increase in cases that other communities have seen have not really been linked to the classroom. They've been linked to other activities that are linked to a school. So extracurriculars and sports and things like that. As long as our schools follow the infection control measures, the risk will be minimal inside the school during class time. So we expect to see some increase in numbers. And thankfully, typically, COVID is less severe in younger kids, but of course there are still severe cases in kids. So there's a bit of concern there.
And what would you say, are the best ways to protect children who cannot get vaccinated yet from the coronavirus?
You know, I think that I hope this isn't taken the wrong way, but the parallel that comes to my mind is what we do with preventing rabies in communities. And I know this sounds a little strange, but what we try to do to protect families is to make sure pets are vaccinated, right? So they have this there's this core of protection, concentric circles, protecting families by having their pets vaccinated. And the parallel, of course, is in the COVID space, if we can keep the other people around the children who are eligible for vaccine, if we can keep them vaccinated, there will be these concentric circles of protection around them. So that means the teachers, the volunteers at the schools. You know, schools are active places, right? They don't just have teachers. They have administrative people. They have parents who come in and help read to kids, other volunteers, custodians. So I think it's really important to take advantage of that opportunity to create that core, that protecting ring around the students who are not yet eligible for vaccine.
Dr. Black, do you agree with that? Does that, I don't know about the rabies.
Absolutely. Yeah, yes. No, I think that's incredibly important. Another thing that we can do to support kids and help keep them safe is just to model the behaviors that we're hoping, you know, they will be employing. So wearing masks when we're out in public as well, to support our children and kind of minimize our chance of getting infected as well, even if we're vaccinated. And then I was really happy to see today the option to opt in for your kids having regular surveillance testing through 4J. So I'm planning to sign up for that for both my daughters, just because information is power for us. And I'm really trying to minimize exposure by identifying any infected cases early on and then supporting people in quarantining when possible. So I think that will be very helpful as well.
Rachel, if I may as well, I'm really glad Dr. Black brought that up. Mm-hmm. So we're lucky to have the University of Oregon here that has brought up this saliva molecular test, you know, really fancy PCR tests. And they have brought it up and got it approved by the FDA for use, which is wonderful. And not just for Lane County, but for other counties as well in the central and southern part of the state. So I know that the leader of that program, his name is Brian Fox at the university, has been promoting this and signing contracts with schools. And it's just a really nice way to do surveillance. And in addition to vaccinating people and having those spheres of protection around kids, having the testing surveillance is really important too. And it's nice that we have the opportunity to just spit in a little vial instead of, you know, swabbing people's noses and such, which is hard for anybody, but especially for little ones.
Yeah, not very comfortable. Well, here's a question that we got via email. This is from Marjorie, who says she has a 11-year and 7-month-old daughter who, you know, she says is tall for her age, and wonders why this hard stop at age 12 for the vaccine. She says her daughter wants it. She wants to be able to, let's see, I'm just trying to shorten this email. She mentions that Canada is vaccinating 11-year-olds and parents across the country are lying about their children's age to get them vaccinated. So why can't doctors take an individualized approach for the vaccine?
I would be happy to start in that space. Mm-hmm. You know, the process in the United States is the manufacturers create their product. They do their safety and efficacy testing in the first couple trials, and then they get to dosing, figuring out what the best dose is. And as part of all of those trials that are required to get not only the effectiveness of the vaccine, but safety, you pull in populations of certain ages. And I think that this parent is right that is there really a huge difference between an 11-year, 7-month-old child and a 12-year, 0-month-old? Probably not. But we are an evidence-based, data-based program for vaccination approvals. And ultimately, you need to draw the line somewhere. And as a parent myself, and Dr. Black, I'm sure, can echo this, you know, I think, again, this caller is right. All kids are a little bit different. They, you know, they mature more quickly in some ways physically, or they mature socially more quickly. But we have to have evidence-based science that will drive us. And the submitted data to the FDA was for 12-year-olds and above. And we're going to get the 5 to 11-year-olds here in the next couple months, some vaccine approved. But right now, this is where we're at with regard to data that supports it.
Dr. Black, do you have any comments on that?
I totally agree with that. And I had heard, although I haven't yet seen what the final proposal will be, that the dosing for 5 to 11 year olds might be slightly different as well. So that could be another reason potentially to stay the course and trust the process. and then see what ultimately is approved for that age group.
Okay. Well, here's a question we got via voicemail. This has to do with kids spending time with their grandparents.
Hi, Drs. Ludke and Black. My name is Ani. I'm calling from Eugene. I have two unvaccinated kids heading back to school. They usually spend one night a week with my vaccinated parents who aren't high risk. My husband and I are vaccinated, and the girls are being really careful at school, even masking at recess. Should we pause the sleepovers for a bit until we see what case rates do with kids being back in the classroom? And just one follow-up, if they can't do sleepovers, can they at least share meals together outside with my parents? Thanks so much.
Oh, I like those sets of questions there. So I'm happy to start this one as well. You know, we really do want to have people socializing, right? I mean, this is especially for kids. It's part of their growing up. It's part of what is needed for kids to grow into this world. And the comment about doing things outside is absolutely the right way to start. So the ambient air provides a huge amount of dilution. There's all sorts of studies showing even a slight breeze, just a couple miles per hour, massively dilutes any virus that people have spoken or coughed out or sneezed out into the air. So what you can do is get together and be outside and enjoy each other's company, have dinner outside. I think that's wonderful. Now, there's a caveat, I would say, for any indoor activity, and that would be, what is the risk of the parents? And it's really important to do that assessment. If these parents are elderly, if they have immunocompromising disease or some chronic lung diseases, it would be wise, I think, to pause for a time. That's where I would go. Interesting in what Dr. Black would say as well.
I would agree. I think it's important to obviously think about the other potential risks for the grandparents. And, you know, some of it is age, certainly other comorbidities. But being vaccinated is a measure of protection, at least to give some confidence in some of those outdoor activities and things where overall, hopefully, the risk is less.
Okay. Thank you. Here we have a question from Cheryl. This is a little bit similar, except among adults. She says, I'm fully vaccinated, but not everyone I know is. Is the risk to me increased by being with an unvaccinated person over another vaccinated individual? And since vaccinated people can pick up and spread the Delta variant, it would seem that the risk to me is the same with the vaccinated or unvaccinated. So what are the facts of this situation?
Gosh, I wonder if I fully understand the question. So what I would say is a preamble, and I'll pitch this one to Dr. Black, too. Maybe she understood it better than I did. So, you know, we learned something really, I think, profound back in 2006. And this might surprise you, Rachel, where I'm going to go with this one. But in 2006, there was a huge mumps outbreak in the state of Iowa. And mumps is a respiratory condition. And it started on college campuses and high schools and middle schools, and people were vaccinated. And when you have a respiratorily spread condition, where unfortunately we all breathe, that puts us at risk. And when you have really intense exposure, like in college dorms, a very small space, people breathing on each other, you can overwhelm the protection of the vaccine. So that doesn't mean it's a bad vaccine. It still might prevent severe disease, but you still might get infected and you might have some symptoms. And we're seeing some of that with intense infectious pressure with some people who are vaccinated and they're at events where they have intense exposure and they get a breakthrough infection. So I think in terms of the risk, she did the right thing by getting vaccinated. And she, in some ways, I think is right that the risk is similar across whatever exposure you get. Either you're going to have a breakthrough or you're not. Dr. Black, what are your thoughts?
Well, it reminds me of what was just quoted from the CDC at the beginning of the show, which was that statistic that people who are unvaccinated are four times more likely to get fully infected with coronavirus, therefore have a viral load that's significant enough potentially to share, and then 10 times more likely to be hospitalized and 11 times more likely to die. So I do think that implies that there's maybe a slightly increased risk of being exposed to unvaccinated people versus vaccinated. But the heart of the matter is that what the vaccine is showing us is that it's actually working, right? I mean, we talk about breakthrough cases, but ultimately that's not a failure because what we're still seeing is it's protective against those hospitalizations and those deaths in people who are vaccinated. So I think really back to the heart of the matter, the best thing anybody can do for themselves to stay safe is to get the vaccine.
Oh, gosh. I think you're exactly right. So now I understand the question. Thank you for picking that out. Yeah, we have a lot of data. Oh, gosh. I think I missed the key point. We have a great deal of data showing that people who are vaccinated, yes, they can get infected. They typically have less viral load, you know, less virus in their bodies. And it's there for a shorter period of time, only a couple days, 3 days, instead of, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 days. So there is a difference. Thanks for the opportunity to weigh in as well, second time.
You're listening to The Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald with pediatric hospitalist Dr. Serena Black with Peace Health and Lane County Public Health's Dr. Patrick Ludke. And I want to play you another voicemail we got that has to do with the vaccine.
Yes, my name is Jenny Foster. I live in Eugene. I have a niece who's 44 years old, and she has a daughter who is 6 years old. My niece had COVID without a lot of symptoms, like a mild flu, back in May. And so now she is insisting that she doesn't need the vaccination because she has antibodies from having COVID, and so she feels that she is now protected. Is that actually the case? I'd be glad to hear your response. Thank you.
I'm happy to start with this one, especially since this is an adult, 44-year-old. So the question was really put together well, such that there's some easy points for me to chime in on. The first is a mild COVID infection in May. We have a fair amount of data showing that people who have mild infections typically, not always, but typically have a lesser antibody response than people who have severe infections. And we are growing data. We have growing data showing that those responses will decay more quickly over time if the infection was mild. It's not perfect data. And again, you know, this pandemic virus has only been here since January of last year, so we still have things to learn. But the fact that this 44-year-old niece had a mild infection means she probably made some antibodies and may have some immunity, but not as much as I think she should want to have. And we also have a good many studies that are now showing that people who've had a prior infection, when they do get vaccinated, they have a big explosion, a huge increase in their antibodies. So I would strongly suggest that she gets vaccinated. And she will benefit from that prior infection because she's already stimulated her immune system a little bit. And when she gets the vaccine, it will be a huge response and a big increase in immunity. Dr. Black, further thoughts?
No, I think that really summarizes it. I had just heard a lot about the potential benefits for those who actually had prior infection in terms of boosting, and even for those who are experiencing some lingering symptoms, actually helping them to have resolution of those symptoms just through the vaccination, kind of supporting the immune response. So that would be all I would add.
Yeah, and I think I had a question that I don't think I brought in, but it did have to do with people who have long COVID and whether they can still be infectious. But maybe one of you could touch on long COVID and the vaccine, like you just alluded to, Dr. Black, that the vaccine can actually help with, it sounds like, with people who have ongoing symptoms.
I would be happy to, I don't know, Dr. Ludke, if you had any information about that.
I would say there are some studies showing, and the trouble is we don't know who it's going to be, showing that people with long COVID, symptoms beyond a month, have benefited from getting vaccinated. And if you think about it from the sensibility of your immune system, if you have long COVID, it might be your immune system's kind of revved up and it's doing things you don't want it to do, similar to some kind of autoimmune responses. And then you rev your immune system a bit more with the vaccine, and then it just kind of calms down and says, okay, I understand, this is normal, and you have better symptoms. But we don't know those persons with long COVID who have a certain type of symptom, you know, just neurological symptoms versus muscular symptoms, that one type will get better with a vaccine than another. We just don't know. That's about the extent of my data. I'm curious in the pediatric adolescent side, Dr. Black, what you have seen in long COVID as well.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I think long COVID is still an evolving entity for children with COVID. And certainly it does exist. And there are multi-specialty clinics that are addressing it sort of around the country. I know Oregon Health Sciences University actually has one. So it's not unheard of. Also, though we think of COVID in pediatric patients as being less severe in general, there is some data out of the United Kingdom that up to 14% of children still experience some ongoing symptoms, not technically long COVID, but just some lingering symptoms in recovery. So not completely benign or harmless, although most recover fully. So I think the thing that's important to know about coronavirus in kids is that there's a lot we just don't know about the impact of the pandemic and the infection on long-term physical health. And so there's a lot to learn as we're going forward still.
Well, last week, the U of O had its first home football game with spectators since the pandemic started. And I know there were a lot of measures in place, including mask wearing. But I know from watching the game on TV that a lot of people didn't seem to be wearing their masks. And Dr. Ledke, I just really wanted to know what your thoughts are about these larger gatherings and what we might be seeing from them in the future.
Well, on the good side, I would say the university, of course, put in place a fair number of infection control measures. So everybody who attended either had to be vaccinated or they had to have had a COVID test within 3 days. And it had to be negative. So the system to check all of that went really, really well. Everybody's vaccine card was checked or their test result was checked. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that markedly decreases the risk. Of course, it doesn't make the risk zero because there are breakthrough infections and somebody could have a negative test and they could still be incubating a small amount of the virus, you know, too small to have a positive test, but the next day it's double or triple what it was the day before and then they become symptomatic. So that was really helpful. There were plenty of opportunities for improvement. You know, Rachel, you talked about masking. We had several people from the health department go there and some other clinical people. And we've had several meetings this week with the U of O for their next home game, which is not tomorrow, but the week after, ways to improve. And they're really collaborative. We're working really hard together to make a difference and make the next game even safer. But, you know, I think the risk is fairly low. It's an outdoor event. And if roughly 75 to 80% of people were vaccinated and the other 20 to 25% had a negative test, we could get some positive transmissions out of there, but not huge, huge, huge numbers. But of course, we're watching our numbers to see.
Mm-hmm. And the U of O is heading into their in-person classes at the end of the month. Meanwhile, Lane Community College has moved to mostly remote classes for at least the first part of fall term. What's your take just on the U of O going back to in-person instruction?
Well, I would say, first of all, we work very closely with both of those institutions. And there is a difference in resources available, you know, between a full-fledged state university and a community college. You know, Lane Community College doesn't have a genomics lab that's doing sequencing and finding Delta variants. They don't have the MAP program that is at Matthew Knight Arena, you know, testing thousands of people. So there's a difference in the ability to, I think, really create some safe harbor, so to speak. So I think that we've worked with President Hamilton, the president of LCC, quite a bit in the last few weeks. On helping to ensure that their process is good going forward. And I think that they made the right decision. It's not 100% virtual. They're going to have some programs that really have to have face-to-face training, you know, the medical, dental programs, et cetera. But I think they made the right decision.
Well, thank you to both of you so much for joining us. I'm sorry we are running out of time, but I just really appreciate both of you joining us here on the Friday show. Dr. Serena Black with Peace Health and Dr. Patrick Ledke with Lane County Public Health. Thank you very much.
Thank you as well. And thanks to Dr. Black for joining us. Sure nice to have other expertise. And thank you for sharing that expertise.
Oh, thank you for including me. I really appreciate it. Thank you for thinking of kids.
Yay.
Yay.
Well, that wraps up the Friday show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. You can listen back to this show and other Friday shows at our website, klcc.org.